Org.
Support for KFAI comes from the Blue Ox Music Festival. 3 days of Americana and bluegrass music featuring national and regional artists. June 25th to the 27th in Eau Claire. Full lineup at blueoxmusicfestival.com.
Just when I thought I was free, my friend.
Did you know you're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio?
That's KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, or online at kfai.org.
Well, you are.
Yeah, I knew that.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You're listening to KFAI on 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. Welcome to Right On Radio.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today on Right On Radio. Today's guest is Ellen Analaba and her newly released translated English book, The Home of the Drowned. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And to get us started, she will read a passage from the novel and then we'll get right into the discussion.
Yeah. I'm not very used to reading English, but I make my bed. Anne mixed her own washing water and scrubbed the roses on the fabric. The edge of the stream was steep, and there was no place to stand. Her arm brushed against Rauna's. Rauna considered what to say. Sometimes she wasn't sure about Anne. She'd become so absent, as if floating between worlds. One underground, just as well as the one with her sister. She and Anne stood beside each other on the first summer night after they had arrived, after Inga had fallen asleep, looking at the lake and the village in the water. It wasn't the nicest skoti we had, Anne had tried to comfort Rauna. No, but it was mine. They had grown up with the same childhood memory of the first stemming, the first memory of the second, but then both adults. The first had been the worst, although there was less water that time. The company had dammed over the village, but most of the grazing lands had remained. The graves were still there. Most of the holy places. And yet, the first time you lose your home, it's overwhelming. After that, you feel less anchored every time. Homeless in part at first, then eventually in whole. Some said it was a kind of a freedom to be able to move where you wanted, but freedom has a warmer color. Freedom was more like the evening sun in the Gohti, not like this. This was the feeling of being frozen.
Thank you.
I think I stopped.
Yeah, you're good. Thank you so much for that excerpt. Just to give a brief overview, do you mind kind of sharing a little bit of background and how you got into writing and just a little bit about yourself?
Oh, how did I get into writing? I think I've always been writing. I was a journalist in the beginning, but I was a really bad news journalist. I always ask too much and wanted to...
Makes you a good journalist is asking too many questions. The job description.
No, but I always wanted to like know more about those things, like in the outskirts of my questions, like the birds and the love and the things, not the news really. So I kind of quickly figured that maybe I'm not to work with news, that I should be working with like longer texts and longer stories. Mm-hmm. And this really, really beautiful storytelling tradition that we have at home in Sápmi, in my land, where we have a lot of people being really, when they start to tell things, it's kind of magic. So I fell in love with that and started to collect those stories. So that's where I started.
So for this book, is this like a collection and amalgamation of those stories that you grew up with as well? And can you just give a brief overview? The Home of the Drowned contains a multi-generational narrative of women specifically. And can you just describe the kind of women that influenced your life and then to this project?
They are Sami women, indigenous women. They are really, they know how to make a living. They can fish, they are reindeer herders, they get wood. Well, they are like managing every aspect of life. So they are like really strong women, but at the same time, very hurt by history, or have to say. So they're like really strong and like really fragile in the same time. So I'm always being fascinated by those women that I had very close to me, and I had those kind of families. And some families with just women, because the men were up in the mountains. So you had these like women families with a lot of aunts and grandmothers and daughters and sons, of course, as well. But in my book, there's just the three of them. So it's a really small family to be a Sami family. Actually, they're often bigger than that. But yeah. In the book, there are three. So there's mother, and that's the aunt Anne, and that's the daughter Inga.
So is the book based off of true events of the Swedish government building a hydro dam in the name of, like, what was it, quote unquote, progress, and that it displaced the indigenous tribes within the area? So that's based off of true events, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was wondering if you just kind of go a little bit overview about that, because this was occurred in the 30s, I believe, like pretty recent.
Yeah, it is. It started in the 20s, and then you had like several dammings. So then the last one was actually in the 70s. Oh. So I'm born in the 80s. So this was just before my time. But the village where I grew up was still like in some kind of shock when I was a kid. So we got to know about the history, and we actually lived by this lake, this big reservoir. So it was like evident what happened, because all the land had been drowned and all the old villages and everything was like underwater. So without asking, of course, because some Samis are, there's an indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And when it happened to the Swedes, and to, they actually asked, and they gave them like new houses, and they gave, but in Sweden you had some kind of idea that indigenous people were like moving, because Sami moving are like nomadic people. So as we were moving, you could just move us. So yep. So I grew up with this story and by this lake. That was not, when I was a kid, it has like been transformed from a lake, and it was actually called the sea because it was so big. So we called it like the sea, because what used to be like seven small lake has become this big, huge, very brutal dam.
I'm kind of curious about the, so this is the second book, I believe, through the University of Minnesota Press, right?
Yeah.
And then you had a previous one. And I'm just kind of curious, what did you change from your previous book to now this one in terms of writing?
Well, they're both very, this is a novel. So, yeah. And the first one is a nonfiction book. So that's, of course, it's a big change. Mm-hmm. But they are very, this book is also very documentary. And I actually had the thinking about making a nonfiction book at first, but then it became a novel. But they are based on this very oral storytelling tradition. So, and I wanted them to be like close to the Sami voice and closer to how people speak. But they are also very poetic, I think, because people have a very poetic way of telling and speaking that I wanted to have in the book. So, and then you have nature also as a kind of person in the novel. The lake, of course, that has this is its own voice, but also the mountains and the glaciers and like the surroundings.
I kind of want to elaborate a little bit about when you mentioned nature as a person. Is that also a part of the Sami tradition as well, as like nature as people and a part of community? Can you elaborate a little bit more for that for our listeners at home?
Yeah, you have, I think, I mean, like in many indigenous communities, you don't make such a big difference between animals and people and nature. And in Sami tradition, you have like the same songs for the same way of singing to animals as to people. And you have, when people are talking about, especially when they are talking about like difficult things and things that have been happening in history, they often speak about nature instead of speaking about themselves, like in some kind of way of, so they are, people are using nature a lot when they speak about what have been happening to them. So when I do that in the book, it's often things that I actually have heard. So I haven't been like making it up. It's how, actually how people talk about themselves and talk about their land and
their life. I want to kind of go a little bit, because this is a book in English, and it's like, well, the one translated here is into English. How was like that translation process? Because this is not the first time one of your works has been translated into English. But for stuff like this, like, do you ever think like words and phrases kind of get lost in translation, so to speak?
Yeah, that's like the way, that's like with translation. There was always been, it's always going to be some kind of violence in that process, because, but I think it's maybe, it's like extra difficult maybe with my books, because they have also a lot of Sami words in it, in the Swedish original text. There is a lot of my Sami language. So it's like a mixture of Swedish and Sami in the beginning, which becomes a mixture of English and Sami in the translation. But I really like how Elizabeth Clark Wessel has translated the book. She's like, so you have the Sami tone or the Sami voice, even though it's in English. And that's beautiful, that even readers in English can some kind of can hear my language. Coming from far away.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful, I never thought of it like that. Yeah, because it's like, because Swedish Sami, and then it's a Sami English, and then just that entire translation process I'm always kind of fascinated by. I just want to talk a little bit about the indigenous activism in Sami history and culture, and your role as an activist. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
Oh, I'm a, I think you might, maybe, is that you don't have actually that big a choice. You almost have to be one, even though you didn't wish to be one. My activism is like kind of a very silent one. It's like a writing activism. So I'm not the one standing on the barricades and demonstrating and sometimes feeling a bit bad about that, just being writing. But we have still, I wish to say that this was like history and this is like a history book, but it's too close to what's happening today in real life. And it's actually also now with the climate changes and that being like very apparent and real in the north, where it's happening really quickly. That was like influenced the book as well when I was writing it. So that is like the big fight we have now to make what we can to avoid the worst to happen.
I was wondering if you can just like elaborate a little bit more about climate change and the Sami people and how that's currently affecting their cult, and like how that also influenced the book, because it's like quote unquote progress to build hydro dams and then climate change currently. And how is that affecting the Sami folks?
Well, we have for a long time now been losing land. So we have been losing land for these kind of hydropower dams and for mines and for the very, very vast forestry they have in Sweden. And then like for maybe, well, the last 10, 20 years, you had like the climate change is coming, like running towards us, which means my family is reindeer herding. So we have animals and they are in the wild, and we never had to feed them. They've always been like in the wild, but for the last, I would say 5 years, they can't find food anymore. So it's like a very big drastic change. So we've actually gone from having animal in the nature to being farming animals in the wintertime to make them survive, which is like a very brutal change of life. So climate change isn't like some kind of future scenario. It's actually really, really, really in the everyday life already.
And I kind of want to go back to the Swedish government. Here in Minnesota, we do have
I believe currently 11 federally recognized tribes, and there's some form of reparations happening as of like last week. The University of Minnesota and the in conjunction with the DNR and the state gave back land from the Colquitt Forestry Service because it was used as a research station and then sold off to timber. Does the Swedish government currently have any sort of land reparations towards the Sami people? You mentioned like building houses, but we're talking about, like land. Land back is kind of our progressive term here.
Not like voluntarily, no. Yeah. But you have the Sami people going to court and like suing the state to make them to. So there have been actually some tribes and areas being successful with that, and then other ones coming like looking at that and saying maybe we could do the same. So we have like the biggest success for some people right now is actually in culture when it comes to literature and film and music, and being that is being like recognized in Sweden and in the other Sami countries as well. But when it comes to rights and land, to those kind of, it's always like hardship for the governments to. So not really, really successful, I wouldn't say.
Hopefully in the future. Is it promising? Do you think it's promising to have some sort of reparations for the Sami people and the Swedish government? Or
I think that what's happening in Anna, I think it's like, even though it's it seems far away, it's good that it's happening in Minnesota, because that will finally arrive. That will like be helping other people in other like different parts of the world, yeah, because we have like a very global world right now. So what is like happening in international will eventually come and help us. I do believe so. I have to believe that.
Yeah. I love what I really like about your novel, particularly is women and kind of get back to the meat of the novel, particularly relationships with mother and the aunt. And as somebody who I don't want to say like inheriting like your family's trauma, but in terms of like indigenous displacement, do you think that's also kind of the fact of like inheriting generational trauma and seeing how do you, I don't want to say cope, but like cope with that sort of living space, quite frankly?
Yeah, I think when you, I'm a mother myself, and I think when you become a mother, you have to think about what you're actually giving and what you're not always wanting the good things, but you are still doing that. So you have like a heritage that is so beautiful and so rich in many ways, but you also have a heritage that you have to, unfortunately, that you are giving without wanting to give it. And you have children that will grow up too quickly into realizing that they will be hearing things and will be like forced to stand up for themselves like in too young age. So I think that's why I'm writing a lot about motherhood and the daughter and the relationship, and also down on the mother not really having time to be a mother. I've been thinking a lot about that. What if you're always like fighting for your rights and for your land, for your village, and for your, and you don't, and you actually should just be a mother.
Yeah.
You should be there for your kids, but what if you don't? You won't find time for that because there's so other fights to have in the same time.
I was kind of curious, do you think like also writing this book would also be helping your children as well to like learn about Sami traditions and the culture and the history as well? I know it's like kind of framed as a novel instead of like, you know, like pure nonfiction. But it's kind of thinking about that in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. Not just my children. I think what we're actually doing in Sami right now is trying to save our history, because it's really fragile. We have this oral tradition, which is a very big, beautiful literature in itself, but it's like based in people that are getting old and that carry those stories, and in that way you can suddenly lose it. So we're trying to write it down and trying to get it into books and into maybe in the future library. We don't have that many books yet, right? But maybe sometime. So there are a lot of writers doing that. And like a difference. I think there's not a Sami person living that have like kind of a history that you understand, like a whole kind of history. I don't know if there are actually people having that, but in Sami life, at least you have a lot of things that you don't know about in history that have been like untold in many ways and in many areas. So we're trying to build that up.
We've noticed, it's like a conversation I had with Janice Fairbanks. She was University of Minnesota Press's Sugar Bush Babies. And she is a Ojibwe language preserver and cultural preserver. And it's the same thing like oral traditions. And that she talks, she speaks. And it's like, they don't, not super like into words, and then like you have to write in English. And it's how do you preserve indigenous culture into like your colonizing language, which is a thought I think a lot of folks in indigenous communities have. But really what you kind of pointed at was like radio or spoken word as a way to preserve it. So like the audio files, the tapes, those MP3s, is there a way that Sami people utilize that to help preserve as well their culture?
Yeah, I know, for instance, that have been like a way of writing with elder people, that way you are actually taping them, because a lot of people can't write. They're like really, really good speakers, but they're like, they never like taught the Swedish language to write in Swedish, and they never ever taught to write in Sami, because you weren't like allowed to have Sami in school. So you're like in between the languages and you have no like written language. Then you have to be going to tapes and to orality. Do you say that? I don't know if that's the word. But you have to be. You have to be. So radio has always been a really, really big thing in Sapmi, because listening and talking, I mean, that is like the core of the core of our language and our life. It is becoming more and more written as well. There is still a lot of people that can't write and that can speak the language, but they can't write.
I had no idea. That's pretty heartbreaking to hear. But hopefully, like, they will preserve the language and then hopefully write it down. But Alain, do you have any last thoughts for us, for our listeners at home, that you would like us to because you're going to be coming in September, I believe.
Yeah, I will. I'm just so very glad because I have been working with literature, and for me the world became like much bigger when I realized that there were like indigenous writers out in the world that I could read. So like it was like the Sami literature was like being like double. I was like doubling it up. I was like having so much to read. So I'm so glad that a book is out in the US, and that because there are some very, very good writers there, and it has been actually been like I think for many Sami people like empowering to have that meeting like in literature and in books and in films and in music with other indigenous people. So it makes me very happy that maybe the book can find some kind of home, as I have found books that have been like a home for me.
Ooh, I'm curious, we do have a little bit of time. What kind of books or other indigenous writers would you recommend, or that you've been really into recently?
I am for the moment, actually right now started, I haven't just started, so I can't say too much, but I'm reading Alexis Wright from Australia. Oh. It's a really, really thick book, praiseworthy, and I just started it, so I can't say. But it's like, and I went to New Zealand last year with my first book about forced relocations, and then there I got a lot of books from Maori writers that I took back. So they have also a really, really beautiful literature from on Aotearoa, New Zealand. And we have some Sami writers as well that have been translated into English. And I think one of the best books, if someone is interested in Sami literature, is a writer called Linnea Axelsson. Mm-hmm. And she's been writing this really, really beautiful epic poem from Sápmi, which is called Ednan, the Land. And that is, like, one of the best books I ever read. So, yeah.
All right. Alain, do you mind reading a small excerpt from your book again while we close out? It is such a beautiful language, and I always love it, hearing authors. And I know, I'm sorry to put English on you.
Do you want it in Sami?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah,
we
do that.
Let's do it. Oh, that's going to make my day. Thank you.
Yeah, I can read the lake, because the lake is actually speaking in books, so I can try to read that in Sami.
Yeah. Yes, let's do it. Yes.
Musley namma manin muhte. Muhtuli äppetjelägasa, enas vodju, muhtuma kouttuhi kirgi. Liten tjälmi ja kätti, kortti ja luofta. Musletje kuolie, tjähti lotti, ta letje hein. Letjen jäuri, ma setje nama ja luedi, takke horrot äppi juikemu. Nana muhtan sin juikenu. Nana hodel dan, tali hodel, nää sattai. Litsen kieta jauri, ku tjähpis piktasa puhti mu tjäädä tjäädä ka milte. Teude mu ja kurri, teude. Välde mu, min mähtän ku seukali. Siivu, mun piuhtan, älp mi hihki mu. Tuotta joga tarvanetje, pakkus tjetnjuretje mu, soten merran. Ja kortsi ei kullunsa, mun tulevan ja pääru loktanetse.
Thank you so much. That was beautiful. Oh, thank you. All right. Thank you, Alain Anna Laba. And your newly released book, The Home of the Drowned, you can find it through University of Minnesota Press. And you can and you will be around sometime in the fall, coming to Minnesota?
Yeah, I will be in Minneapolis, in the middle of September-ish.
Ooh, yeah, somewhere around there. We'll find more information and keep that posted on for you. But thank you again for joining us for Ride on Radio.
Thank you.
Support for KFAI comes from First Avenue, presenting Killed by Kiwis at the 7th Street Entry, Saturday, June 13th. The Twin Cities' very own Killed by Kiwis has taken inspiration from garage rock, glam rock, synthwave, post-punk, and psychedelia, forging a sound that frequently crosses genres and themes. They are celebrating the release of a new EP, The Party Addendum. Opening the show are fellow local acts Sunflower and Mary Jam. More information about Killed by Kiwis at the 7th Street Entry is available at first-avenue.com.
Support for KFAI comes from The Dakota, presenting the Kronos Quartet for two shows each night, Thursday, June 18th and Friday, June 19th. The Kronos Quartet returns to record a new live album at The Dakota over these two evenings and four performances. These shows will feature thought-provoking programs built for the current moment in Minneapolis. With songs written or arranged especially for them, Kronos will musically examine human rights and reflect on the here and now. They'll be joined by powwow singer Joe Rainey and multi-instrumentalist Andrew Broder. More information about the Kronos Quartet's live album recording performances is available at dakotacooks.com.
You are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. This is Ride on Radio, the show where we talk about all things literary. Tonight, Emma sits down with Janice Fairbanks to talk about her book, Sugarbush Babies, Stories of My Ojibwe Grandma. Then afterwards in the show, Eric sits down with Timothy Odie about being the co-owner of Wild Rumpus Books, a children's bookstore based out of Minneapolis. Stay tuned for Ride on Radio. All right, I have Janice Fairbanks here to talk to her, with her about her book, Sugarbush Babies, Stories About My Ojibwe Grandmother. Thank you so much for being with us today, Janice.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
So my kind of softball question here is, what prompted you to write this?
Probably my grandmother, because it's stories I've been writing all of my life. Mm-hmm. They've just recently come together in a book and been published. So a lot of things prompted me to write those original stories. And it was just the way I grew up, I guess, going from a reservation to a city and then back to a reservation and back and forth. And all of my experiences along there, and they all tied right back to my grandma. So
were you always considered a writer then, or?
Oh, I was considered a writer since second grade.
Oh my God.
Yes, I was. Because I mean, I did start storytelling, writing my own stories in second grade. And of course, they evolved a little bit beyond my second grade abilities. But my classmates liked them, so that was good enough for me.
Were you always a big fan of writing fiction more, or like, what was like kind of writing that you gravitated towards?
I like history.
Okay.
And in a way, my writing has always been history. It's been the history of the Ojibwe people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's fact-based. It's actual stories of things life. So for my reading material, I do like reading biographies, autobiographies. Mm-hmm. I like reading about people to kind of see what motivates people or what turns them off. You have to know those things to get along with people. And I really like people. I mean, I want to get along with people, so I want to make sure I don't offend anybody. Sometimes I probably do, but it's not intentional.
Yeah. I'm curious where the title Sugarbush Babies comes from.
That was my grandma. Yeah. My grandma was a Sugarbush baby. She was actually born at Sugarbush Camp. And Sugarbush is when the season turns in March to go, usually in March, to go out into the woods, tap trees to make the maple sap. Mm-hmm. And back in those days, when she was born in 1895, it was the woman's job to do that. Now everybody does it, men, women, children, but it was women's work. And so she was out there and with her mother, not born yet, but in the middle of all that, then she was born on March 11th at Sugarbush. So when she told me the story of her birth, she referred to herself as a Sugarbush baby. So that just kind of stuck with me that, she's a Sugarbush baby. And she continued tapping trees well into her old age. All her life, she was Sugarbush baby.
That sounds like is it a pretty strenuous labor, do you think, or is it pretty stressful?
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, and it takes time to tap the trees, and then you have to wait for the sap to run and fill the little, in those days, she used coffee cans and cedar taps. Now they have all kinds of fancy equipment, tubing and everything. Well, back then, she didn't. She was walking the woods and carrying those pails, and she had a couple of her regular people that came to Sugarbush to help her. She had her Uncle Mike, and then there was a guy named Tommy Stevenette. Mm-hmm. Those were her two regular helpers. And they did a lot of the heavy work, but she did quite a bit too, pouring the sap from the pails onto the fire and watching that and making sure it didn't burn as it boiled down. It's a lot of labor, and it goes on until... They say until the frogs start singing. When you hear the frogs start singing, it's time to stop that tapping the trees.
Oh, that's so cool. My next question is, there's a lot of photos. One of my favorites, I think it's in the prologue, and especially towards the end in the epilogue with like your grandmother in the jingle dress. What was it like going through all these photographs to include or exclude? Can you describe that a process?
Well, I have a collection, and that picture has always been one of my favorites. It's on my wall. It's always been hanging on my wall, that one of my grandma. And when I got to be about the same age, I put on my jingle dress, and I pose like her.
Oh,
and that's
God.
In the book too. They're across from each other. That younger version of me is across from my grandma, and they were about the same age when those pictures were taken. So, you asked me, what was it like going through all those pictures?
Yeah.
Actually, the publisher asked me for certain illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
So all I had to do was go through and find illustrations that fit what they asked for.
Perfect.
So it wasn't too hard. I got direction on that.
Yeah. Were there like ones that you really, really wanted to include? Did you find like while you're going through these photographs, you were rediscovering some photos that you're like, oh, I didn't know about this or things like that?
The pictures of my elementary years were kind of a surprise. Somebody sent me that picture that it's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And was at Franklin anyway. I had one from Jackson. I don't know. One of them wasn't good enough to go in the book. Not high enough resolution. When I say not good enough, it wasn't high enough resolution. So that one didn't get in there. But one of them did. And that one was sent to me by one of my classmates who was in the elementary school with me. So that was a surprise.
I think because like when it comes to like memoirs or talking about other people or stories, what was your friends, family's reaction to you writing this book? Were they kind of stoked, kind of shocked, or were they like, oh, this is just a natural progression for your literary career?
My friends' families? I'm
or
not
like
sure
your
I
friends,
understand the question.
Like your friends and family members, when you're writing this book or you're telling them that you're writing this memoir.
They were remembering, it was helping them remember some of their own childhood memories, which is good.
Yeah.
They told me stories that they're their stories, so they didn't get into my book.
Yeah.
But I told them they should write a book.
Yeah.
There's some interesting thoughts out there. And then I've heard from a lot of my friends that heard some of the stories, because I've done occasional readings just because I had these stories all these years. They just weren't in a book. They were in a manuscript.
Yeah.
So I would read from them from time to time, and that would have the same effect on them. They would remember their grandmother in particular. That came up pretty often. Oh, I remember my grandma. I wish I would have visited her more. I wish I would have talked to her more. There's a lot of that. And that's just so important. If you've got your ancestors right there, spend time with them and talk to them. It's way more interesting than anything I can think of. That was just, it's just my outstanding memory of my life was spending conversation time with my grandma.
This book actually inspired me to talk to my grandmother a little bit. She's in her mid-80s. She's my last living grandmother. And she did grow up on a reservation in upstate New York. And I never really asked her questions about it that much. And so thank you from a personal note, because that's inspiring me to ask her questions about like what it was like growing up in rural upstate New York. So thank you for that. I don't think I would have thought much about it.
Was it a Mohawk reservation by any chance? What was the name of the reservation?
It was a Tuscarora, I believe. And our family is
Tuscarora, yeah.
Yeah. Our family's very white. We don't have indigenous culture, but she somehow grew up on a reservation. I don't know exactly how that happened. And then they moved closer to Niagara Falls, Buffalo area after she was a kid. So I thought that was
Is your grandmother Tuscarora?
No, her,
oh,
she's second gen Polish. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, all right. It was weird. From what she told me, it was all the reservation Native American kids it was 50% Polish and like other Eastern European kids. And then the other half were Native American reservation kids. And there are some like three or fourth cousins removed on my side of the family that I know still live on the reservation, but I never actually met them because the family lineage just kind of died down like that. But I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah.
I like never actually asked her questions about the,
you better start asking
before
you'll think of them later. It'll be too late, but ask them while you can.
Yeah. What I was really struck by in the book was the humor in a lot of things, especially I think one of my personal favorite passages was, I believe it was you reminiscing about how blue-eyed kids can see. And I thought that was very, very funny. Was humor like a part of this process as well? Or
humor is a part of my life.
Yeah.
I love to play with words, and somebody will say something to me and I'll say something else back. You know, I know what they said, but my dad used to do that too. And so it was kind of a learned behavior, but I thought it was fun. So I just carried it on. Yeah, I play with words a lot.
Oh, God, there's so much. I really love that passage. I think it's so funny. But one of the things I really wanted to talk about was in your biography, you also do a lot of work preserving and revitalizing the Ojibwe language. How does that work tie into this book? And I want you to kind of elaborate more on that.
I might have used a few Ojibwe words in there.
Yeah.
But it was mainly written in English. I have done work based on those stories that is all in Ojibwe, or it's bilingual, and it's a series of cartoons that are found on the Fond du Lac Reservation language and culture website. They're out there as resources. And they're little cartoons. I'm going to bring those into the presentation I'll be doing later this month with the Minnesota Indian Education Conference.
Yep.
They invited me. They picked my book to put in the conference bag. So I thought I'll go down there and sign books and I'll tell them a little more about it. But a little more about it includes that I had already done other stories. There might be a story or two in my book that's also in the cartoons. Certainly will be reference to it. But they're just little, no more than 5-minute cartoons. And they're bilingual. There's a little book that goes along with them. People can read them either in English or in Ojibwe or both with subtitles. So that's, not sure I answered your question. I forgot to talk anymore. Oh, Dad, I forgot what your question is.
I'm curious, how did you get into like this very laborious preserving the Ojibwe language? I'm kind of curious.
It's a struggle.
Yeah.
How did I get into it? My grandma, of course. Everything leads back to grandma. She taught me words when I was just, you know, a little kid. I didn't really know what she was saying, but then I figured it out because she wouldn't say it in English.
Yeah.
And it's just real simple thing. Bilisinin. And okay, bilisinin. And here she's setting the table, putting food on. Okay, I connect. That means come and eat.
Yeah.
So I learned by listening to her and watching what she was doing. And she just made it known what she meant. And I don't know. When I was in the city, big city, Detroit, Michigan, and I worked for, I was executive director of an Indian center. We had Indians from all over the country. It wasn't just Ojibwe, but they wanted to learn Ojibwe. We had a Navajo student coming to Ojibwe class.
Huh.
We had some Oneida students coming to Ojibwe class. Well, then we figured, well, they're across the border. Why don't we get a teacher from over there to come and teach them Oneida? And we have an Ojibwe instructor, you know, kind of built in. I mean, I couldn't do everything, but I could organize it. And if the instructor was absent, then I could step in. And it's more of a process of finding the resources to support it than to doing the actual work. Like even after I stepped off the, I retired from being the Anishinaabemowin coordinator for Fond du Lac. And I took a year to do some other things, including writing this book. And then I went back and they, lo and behold, elected me to be the chair of the committee.
Yes.
I was going to go and I just wanted to be like secretary or some minutes and all that kind of stuff. But they wanted me as chair. So I'm in my second term as chair and I'm trying to get somebody groomed to step into that. Maybe that'll happen, and maybe it won't happen in the near future. At some point, it will happen. But I just keep pushing, and all the speakers I know, I try to sign them up to do presentations or point them toward opportunities where they can present, because there's a lot of really good second language learners, and now they're teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And they just need to keep doing that, just keep recycling through and build it up. And that's what they're trying to do.
That is so beautifully said. Are you excited for the future of preserving the Ojibwe language and culture? Are you excited, like, looking forward in the near future to, like, newer generations?
I'm looking forward to people not losing momentum, which mm-hmm. I've, from what I've seen since I've been back in Minnesota, it's been 10 years now. There's a lot of regional speakers. Mm-hmm. And they know each other, and they cooperate with each other, and they lift each other up. And that, to me, is a huge sign of hope.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. And I go to any of their presentations as I can. I had to miss two nights of our storytelling here that just took place last week because I had other meetings. And I thought, well, maybe I'll get out early enough to go. Well, I got out at 6:15, and it started at 6.
Yeah.
So to get from where I was over there, by the time I get there, it'd be almost over. So that kind of stuff is disappointing. But at least I know they went on with it, and they're doing it, and they're organizing it.
Oh, that's so cool. I want to kind of go back to the book a little bit, where you talk about walks with nature and grandma and all these other, definitely like the ties of her being in nature. Do you think that influenced you as a person quite a bit as well?
Oh, it definitely did. Yeah. If I hadn't had those walks out in nature and her encouragement to tell me about it and what I saw, I would not have the level of attention to detail that I have today. And it's not just out in the woods. It's everything around me.
Yeah.
It's just hypersensitive to any little detail.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes body language. I could look at people, and if they're saying one thing and doing another, I detect it.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of know where most people are coming from when they're interacting with me.
Did you have a favorite story that your grandma told you, or one that you're like, this is one I want to be heard over and over and over again?
That was her story of Sugarbush.
Yep.
Her story of being born at Sugarbush. I never got tired of it, and neither did she.
Yeah.
And if she would not tell me, you know, for a while, she didn't mention, I'd say, Grandma, where were you born? Where exactly were you born? Or try to make her add that little turnabout's fair play, make her add a little more detail to what she's telling me. But she would tell the story, and she really liked it.
All right. My next, one of my last questions here, I think I have two more. What is your favorite memory of your grandma? If you had to pick a handful, I know it's very difficult for a personal question. But if you had one that's just like, this story or this memory really embodies who my grandma was as an individual, if you had to pick one.
Well, there was these quiet days we had when we did laundry. We did laundry outside the tubs. We had to haul the water and get it all ready and then hang it on the line. And that, you know, this is an all day process. So while the laundry was drying, we didn't just sit there and wait.
Mm-hmm.
She was knitting a pot holder, and she had spare yarn and spare needles, and waited for me to ask and say, come over here, I'm going to teach you how to do this. I said, Grandma, what are you doing? Oh, I'm making a pot holder. I said, oh, can I try? So she had a chair for me already. We always had the same chair as we sat on outside the door. So I went and sat by her, and she gave me the needles and showed me how to start, and mm-hmm. here, do this and this, and showed me the stitch. And I did. And we sat there and we were just talking. I was watching what I was doing, watching what she was doing. And she didn't say much. She just stopped. And we then she was done. So she finished hers. And I said, I think I'm done too. But I looked at mine, and it was about the size of a you know, those things you put under cups. What do you call those?
A coaster?
You set your coffee on. Coaster. Mine was only about the size of a coaster. Hers was the size of a regular pot holder. And I looked at it and I looked at hers and I said, oh, grandma, I can't do it. It's miserable. I failed. I can't do it. And she picked it up and she, here, let me see that. And she took it and she turned it and then she turned it sideways, looked at it. She said, oh, it's just right. Here, let me put a corner on it and we're going to hang it on the wall side by side. Mm-hmm. I said, but yours is bigger. She said, that's okay. You just knit. You're a little tighter than I do, but this will work. So she never agreed with me that I was a failure. She looked at it and said, this is good. This will work. And so they hung there in our little kitchen, side by side, my little coaster next to her pot holder. But it had a little handle on it, just like hers. So, yeah, that is one of my favorite memories that really embodies who she was and how kind she was. She was just kind and such a teacher.
Oh, that's such a beautiful, note, a beautiful story. I really enjoyed listening to you recount that. And I think my final question is, based off of the story you just told me and any other facts that you would want people when they're reading the book to know about your grandmother or in Ojibwe culture in general?
Well, grandma was really a smart woman. She was born in 1895, but during her young years and growing up years, Native people weren't really hired for anything. It didn't matter how smart they were. They could be laborers. They could be house cleaners, domestics. And I remember reading a letter to her that somebody wanted her to come and be their house cleaner because she had high recommendations from somebody else. And I thought, oh, my God, my grandma was so smart. She, I don't know if she took that job or not. She was a young lady when that letter came to her. But in her later life, she was the first woman on our reservation business committee. She is very smart. She worked at the organizing rights for Native people even before she got on that committee and long after she got off of it. She was a human rights activist. That's what I want people to know about her. She was a true matriarch. She looked after her family and she looked after the entire tribal nation.
That's
who my grandma was.
That's so sweet. I wish I could have met your grandma. I'm really grateful that you're able to. I'm very grateful that I'm able to meet your grandmother through you and through your book, Sugar Bush Babies. Thank you so much, Janice, for being with us today on KFAI 90.3 FM on Ride On Radio. It was such a pleasure having you on the air.
Thank you.